to ask a quick question.
That's fine.
You can come back at the beginning of the break and if people have questions. Good. Thank you very much. We're going to do something now that's more in line with what we were doing this morning, and that is to have another panel on one of the foresight challenges. This one is going to be on providing abundant clean water globally, and the panel is on nanotech for clean water. The chair of this, the moderator, is Anthony Waits, who is the managing partner of Quantum Insight. He's spent the last several decades doing management, strategy, and technology development. As a managing partner at Quantum Insight, which he founded in 2001. Some of the interesting things that he's done is serving on Congressman Mike Honda's task force on nanotech, serving on the executive committee of Joint Venture Silicon Valley's Nano Initiative, and authoring a chapter on commercialization of nanotech for a report to the California legislature. Anthony holds a master's from the Stanford School of Engineering and from the Stanford Graduate School of Business. And I will now turn it over to you. Will you take care of the other introductions?
Sure.
Okay. Thank you. Anthony.
Thank you. So can you, do we want to go one at a time, or how do you want to, is this pure panel or any presentation?
Yeah, there's presentation.
Sorry, are they here?
Your governor has one, too.
Okay.
Each of us has been asked to give a presentation.
Okay. Sorry, the book with the bios here is wasn't turned to the right page. So thank you all for coming. Our first speaker, we'll go starting with Fred. So the first speaker is Fred Tepper, and Fred, in 1994, Fred formed Argonaut Corporation as a vehicle to invest personal funds and commercialize Russian nanotechnology. In 1996, he retired from MSA to develop Argonaut. Argonaut's principal mission is in nanotechnology with a focus on water treatment. Argonaut has been awarded two phase two SBIR contracts. So that's impressive. And the company's filter technology has received the 2005 Hall of Fame Space 2005 Hall of Fame Space Foundation. So, Fred?
Yeah, just a bit of background at mine safety. I started out in filtration engineering. I had a very lovely career with them, 40 years, and finished up managing a whole bunch of profit centers, including one in chemicals, one in instruments, and one in batteries. And I was enamored with the technology that was available in Russia. Excuse me, could you please help me with this? Yes, please. I'd had some interaction with the Russians going way back. And while at mine safety, I learned of some technology related to trace detection. I became interested in it. And along about my retirement, I thought I needed to start a second career, hopefully another one lasting 40 years. That would be nice. I was looking around for technologies, and the Russians, my Russian associates put me in touch with a group in Central Siberia that was interactive with what they called ultra-dispersed technology, which we call nano. And I became interested in it, started investing my personal money into it, and then tried to help them also try to market the product. Then I got some help from the U.S. government to support them because a lot of them were former weapons scientists, nuclear weapons scientists, and the government very much liked to keep them off the street. This was kind of a help to the program and to our business. So with that, let me get the show on the road. Slideshow. View show. Okay. I've got some of our sponsors down at the bottom. thank goodness for them. I founded the company to develop nanopowders using this Russian technology. They had a process for making metal nanopowders for a wide variety of applications. The process they had involved converting a wire in a continuous fashion into nanometal aerosolized nanometal particles, which froze. We collect them and we sell them. We basically can make any of the soft metals like indium, copper, go on up to tungsten, high melters, intermetallic alloys, and so on. I realized along about the way that this was like had the same kind of future as nano. It was way out in the future. We needed to vertically integrate something that we could get some shorter-term cash out of. Because of my prior background in filtration, I was able to take one of the powders and I invented a filter media based on a nano-aluminum powder. We'll get into that in a bit. The project was supported by NASA, Department of Energy, Air Force, EPA, DITRA. We have a U.S. patent that's issued, a EU patent that will issue. Others in process. We have separately developed an arsenic sorbent, which will be available in 2007. Air filters are in development. I'm sorry, that's 2006. Air filters are in development. We'll talk about that. And there's a proprietary medical product that's feasible, but I put it on ice simply because we don't have the money to be able to pursue all these lovelies at the same time. Source of funds, we've gotten about $2 million from SBIRs. We've been very fortunate there. There was about $2 million worth of U.S. government funds to support our Russian partners, and they've been invaluable in our work. I put in well over $1 million of my personal cash, plus considerable sweat equity, and not drawing money from the organization. This is a picture of a very, very interesting material. That's the basis of our filter. It's a nano-alumina boamide, A-L-O-O-H fiber, only 2 nanometers in diameter. The nanofibers are highly electropositive. They're smaller, they're about the same size as a carbon nanotube or a DNA molecule. And we take that, we make it into a paper type of filter using cellulose, polymer, and glass fibers. That's what it looks like. Essentially, the real strength, if you gather up these fibers, as produced, they're rather useless because they're highly agglomerated. Can't hardly pass anything through them. But as part of our technology, we've learned how to put these on another fiber, a coarser fiber. Here you see a glass fiber running north-south. Here we have our arrow showing. You see the fuzz on this glass fiber? That's the good stuff. That's the nano-alumina. When it gets clunky like this, it's not very useful. So we make this fiber media. The filter, it's very capable of filtering submicron particles by electrostatic forces and does it with high efficiency and at a high flow rate. The nanoalumina attracts particles like a dirt magnet. It retains particles which include silica, natural organic matter, metals, carbon, bacteria, DNA, and most important is virus. Pleated cartridges such as this are now being sold for industrial, commercial, and residential applications. A thicker filter is being developed for filter sterilizing drinking water, and that's very, very close. We've demonstrated feasibility of an improvement over HEPA filters that are used in air filtration. It is a paper-type product made at a paper mill. And there's a single roll of it. Basically, this media is being made as we speak in significant quantity at a paper mill. Features and benefits of the media, the flow rate is 10 to hundreds of times greater than membranes. Separate submicron particles by charge rather than size. We have a higher filtration efficiency than membrane filters, and it's much more resistant to clogging. Just to get a sense of what happens when you start adding this nanoalumina, you see here basically nanoalumina on glass. That's what the voltage of the glass is when you measure the zeta potential. As you increase the nanoalumina content, The voltage shifts from negative to positive, and this is what happens to the filter when you try to flow virus. We use MS2, which is bacteriophage, 25 nanometers as a challenge particle. This is what happens to the filtration efficiency. When you get up to about 15 weight percent, doggone this hour, there it is, you really go off the charts. It winds up being extraordinarily efficient. This shows the amount of dirt holding capacity of some of this media for A2 fine test dust, which is a particle that's routinely used for challenging filters. It's about four microns in size. We have a capacity, dirt holding capacity, 20 times greater than microglass filter media and about 300 times greater than your melt blown or membrane media. This results in remarkable savings to users, particularly when filtering colloidal matter. The flow capacity of this media, as compared to 1 micron media of other types, is substantially greater. Let's see if I can get my arrow working again. Yep. This shows what happens when we take essentially river mud, 250 NTU of this dirt, and pass it through this filter. Measuring the effluent on the other side, we can't find any dirt coming through. The efficiency is greater than 4/9 retention of this dirt while flowing 1.5 gallons worth of this fluid through this per minute. It's extraordinary in terms of the amount of particles it will retain, as much as 1/4 pound of this before it chokes because of excessive pressure drop. The filter is ideal for sampling of municipal well water and seawater for virus contamination. Very good application for it. The filter will take out RNA and DNA, much as it does virus. This is an experiment we did where we took a 2-nanometer particle ink, and we used it to challenge filters using a hypodermic syringe. In this particular picture, you can see the person trying to push the fluid through the filter contained within a filter holder here into a bottle, there is extraordinary back pressure on it because the filter that was used is a membrane filter, which is 25 nanometers. At the end of the day, there really was no color taken out by that membrane filter, and you can see it was essentially pure white. We tried the same trick with our filter here, and essentially very easy to move the fluid through the filter, and look what happens to the filter. It's got all the color on it. We made cartridges all the way up now to 4.5 by 20 inches high. This is an interesting experiment, the sodium chloride aerosol penetration. It's characteristically used for determining the effect on the retention. It's a way to characterize HEPA filters. This is the air penetration curve, the one on the blue line. Let's see now, where's my arrow? There it is. This is the curve for HEPA. This is the curve for 3 layers of this filter media, which is actually far better than HEPA in terms of retention. This is ULPA, which is ultra-low particle air filter media, 99.49 retention. So we have a much better filter media than HEPA itself. This is what happens, this one over here. We take 1 layer of this media and put it over the HEPA. We actually substantially improve on the HEPA. This is a measure of the pressure drop that coincides with the data I just showed you with respect to penetration, whereby this is the HEPA now. What happens is the particle loads up quickly. The delta P goes up much, has a much higher rise trend. This is the media, 3 layers of our media. And this is what happens when we add a single layer over the HEPA filter. In a sense, if you were to define the end of life of this filter as 80 millimeters pressure drop, you have something about 60 minutes versus the HEPA, which is somewhere around 11 or 12. So it's about 5 times greater life as a result of having used a thin layer of this media as a facing material for a HEPA filter. Applications for all this technology, portable handheld, I'm talking about water now, drinking water, handheld devices for campers, military emergency water, point of use in residential environments, at the kitchen sink, in a pitcher, in a refrigerator, emergency water systems, a terrible burden. Now, you're going to hear more from that from Mr. McGovern, associated with poor water in less industrialized countries and village wells, as an example. The filter is extraordinarily good as a pre-filter to protect and optimize reverse osmosis for purifying coolants like removing Legionella from HVAC systems, filtering metalworking coolants, purification of bio and pharma fluids. The filter will remove endotoxins, of course, and virus, and separation of proteins. We have some real concepts relative to proteins. We're not a biological house, and I really would like to talk to somebody, perhaps any of you in the audience, who have the tools that can make that we can collaborate with us and try to demonstrate the process for an efficient process for separating proteins and microbiological particles, one from another. Other applications, swimming pools and spas, processing food and drink, biological and virus detection schemes. We do have a virus, SBIR program in progress where we're using the filter as a collector and a concentrator for biological detectors. We can enhance their sensitivity by several orders of magnitude. Improved HEPA for clean rooms, operating rooms, homes. And we have an SBIR progress from the Air Force relative to that issue. Respirators, surgical, industrial, SARS and bird flu, civilian masks, lots of application for this kind of media. We've also developed an arsenic filter media. That's because they're really, after microbiological toxins, arsenic is the next greatest problem. Basically, the regulations in the U.S. and elsewhere require going from 50 to 10 parts per billion effective January 06, 11 million households affected. It's an ecological disaster in Southeast Asia affecting tens of millions. We developed a granular sorbent. It was 2 to 3 times the dynamic capacity versus competitive sorbents, but only at 1 pH. We sent the formulation to our Russian partners and asked them to improve it. They did. And what you see here is the company A, and I'll not mention them, but we regarded that particular sorbent as the gold standard. This is what we did in the laboratory. We sent the technology to our Russians, and that's what they did with it. Incidentally, that's with the tube half the size, half the height of what we had here when we tested these two, benchmarked one against the other. This shows the function at pH 8.5. We really were not even as good as the company A sorbent at that high pH, but here's what our Russian associates did with it. They basically have about 4 times the capacity. Our business plan really is to promote our pleated cartridge for many industrial applications, to scale up our point-of-use virus filter and manufacture it, to develop a refrigerator, a pitcher, a portable drinking water filter, to develop distribution partners in the diverse markets, to manufacture and distribute air filter media, and to partner with a respirator manufacturer. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Fred. And I guess we'll just hold the questions until the end.
Yes, and if I could get my computer back.
Given that my name is at the end of the alphabet, I'm sensitive to that, so I'm going to go and continue my trend in going in reverse alphabetical order. So our next speaker will be Kevin McGovern. Kevin is the chairman and CEO of McGovern Capital, LLC, which is an intellectual property rights strategy and originates, structure, and implements capital formation and does joint ventures and business alliance. They focus in early stage capital and provide facilities such as legal, accounting, tax, securities, et cetera, services to their investment companies. If you're interested in submitting a business plan, you can send it to plans@mcgoverncapital.com, and you should look at their website for criteria. Kevin has been a principal negotiator or a participant in over 40 strategic alliances, approximately 40 of which have been with foreign ventures. He has a lot of experience in this area. He is also the chairman of Engstrom Publishing LLC. In 2000, Engstrom entered into a joint publication agreement with Forbes to produce the famous Forbes Wolf Nanotech letter, which has been the fastest growing product for a newsletter launch in Forbes history, and is currently their fastest growing newsletter. So, I'd like you to welcome Kevin.
Thank you very much. It's really a pleasure being here. And Fred, I got to tell you, that was a very detailed and very analytical discussion. I'm going to give a more general discussion because I am not the scientific part of my company, KX Industries. And so what I'd like to do is just give you a little bit of an overview of McGovern Capital real quickly. Then we're going to talk about the water market. You know about it, but I'd like to give you some little information I think would be fascinating to you. And then tell you about the issues globally of water and nano, and what issues Fred, myself, and William are trying to overcome. And this is more of an overview, and I hope you'll learn something from it. Quickly, McGovern Capital, as some of you know, is basically what we are as an IP strategist. And we help companies who have platform or disruptive technologies roll their technologies out globally. We've been involved in low tech. We were the founders of Sobe Beverages, which was the leader of nutraceutical industry. Medium tech, we own the patents with the two inventors of alpha hydroxy acids, which are about in 40% of all skincare products worldwide. It's considered about an $8 billion business, AHAs. High tech, we own VLIW, and we license such companies as Intel and HP for microprocessing architecture. So we're sort of in the range of a lot of different things, whether it's various levels of tech. What we're going to talk about a little bit today is KX Industries. We've been involved in KX Industries for about 17 years. KX was the company who created the first pure end-of-tap filter, created the first Brita end-of-tap filter, and then created the first refrigerator filter, which was distributed and produced by Electrolux. So we've basically been the creator and the producer of, in terms of the household market, probably every new innovation in the last 15 years. And we think we have something very special that we're launching globally right now. Now, let's talk about the water business just quickly. It's a huge business, and that's why Fred, myself, and William are looking forward to penetrating it. It's about a $400 billion market worldwide. It's growing by about 40% by the year 2025, which is double the rate of the world's population. We have a crisis. I'm not going to tell you. You're very intelligent people, but it's amazing. I'd like to give you some of the stats because I always find them very, very fascinating. According to the United Nations, I think it's far bigger than this. 1.3 billion people already lack access. I think that's a much bigger number. What some people don't realize is how little of the Earth's surface of water is really drinkable. And 97% of the surface is water, but only 0.4% is accessible fresh water. It's a huge amount of water. Very little water can we drink. The water scarcity and stress problem as it's going out is humongous. The water issue today is severe. It'll get worse and worse. Some people say it's the biggest issue on the planet. I agree. Rising use, you can see agriculture, you don't always think of it, is a huge consumer of the planet's water. And also we have industrial as well as municipal. Huge consumption. Some people contend, and some people have been contending for years, that future wars in this planet will be fought not over oil, although that's a little hard to believe considering developments in the last year or two, but over water. I certainly hope not. And as I said to Fred earlier today, whoever is in this business, there's plenty of room for everyone. I hope we all solve the issue of waterborne diseases. How big is that issue? It kills, I talk about the base of the pyramid. I'm very much associated with Cornell University, as is Norm Scott in the audience. And we work on the impact on sustainability quite a bit through one of our superstar professors, Stu Hart. But I really look for technologies particularly that approach the base of the pyramid, the 4 billion people who make less than $2 a day. And nanowater is certainly one of those. The numbers, 4 billion cases of diarrhea disease alone, they literally paralyze countries. 6,000 children die a day. It's equivalent to 20 jumbo jets. I'll get to the point here. I think this statistic is staggering. About one half of your hospital beds in the world are occupied by people with waterborne diseases. Now, what are the type of pollutants that we all have to deal with, everyone on this panel, and all of us as human beings have to deal with? First of all is the particulate matter, which are minerals and organic material, chemical pollutants, and disease-causing agents. That's bacteria, virus, and parasites. To have a true solution, you have to deal with all three, and you have to be able to virtually eliminate all of those. Now, what are your treatment methods currently? Boiling is somewhat expensive. Some people on the panel may not agree, but it's somewhat expensive. We think we have a technology that's less expensive than boiling, but it is ineffective against certain of those pollutants that we talked about. So is chemicals. Somewhat ineffective against chemicals. Solar, ineffective against chemicals, as well as pathogens. Filtration devices have traditionally been ineffective against pathogens. We think we have an answer to that. And then UV, of course, against chemical pollutants. Okay, so what are the issues that a nanowater solution has to overcome? One, it has to treat viruses. And we at KX feel that we have a solution. And again, my partner has really stressed to me not to divulge too much at any public forum. So I'm a little gagged. I'd love to talk about it a little bit more. But the solution has to virtually eliminate all viruses. And best I know, Fred, and you correct me, you're the scientist, I'm not. The smallest virus that we've got to deal with in water is most likely polio, which molecule is about 25 nanometers large. So your solution, your nano solution, has to be way down below that and has to be effectively eliminating it and has to have a gravity flow where it's eliminating that pathogen and that virus and have a gravity flow to make sense to the consumer. Quite a challenge. You have to have a separation, but you not only have to have a separation, you have to have an elimination. The last thing you can do on your filter, whatever device you're using, is accumulate, in my opinion, the bacteria and viruses. That's not going to do you a whole lot of good. You may be creating more of a problem than you're curing. It has to be extremely durable. The technology that we're seeking and that we're hoping to deliver very soon is a technology for not just we Americans in this room, but for the 4 billion people who are out in those huts and using lots of water. And Fred, you sound like you have a wonderful solution for one of the major issues is mud and dirt. But you're going to have a solution that's highly durable and highly applicable to people who are going to use it for various purposes that you never imagined. One of the uses, I've had to travel the last year and a half around the world meeting with various leaders, and one of the uses they said is they're going to use your technology for a vase, for a stool, for anything they can use because you have a household solution. That household does not have a lot of space, so they're going to use it for various purposes. So you have to take that into account, which we believe we have. You got to make sure that you have security against knockoffs, particularly in specific countries that we all don't need to mention, but it's a big deal. So how do you ensure that it's a self-contained, closed system, secure against knockoffs? And most importantly, in my opinion, again, we may intelligently differ on this panel as well as out there, it's got to be at a price point. We look at it, it's got to be at a price point that's changing your pocket, and that's when you're in India, Africa, and China. So it's got to be less than a dollar for a significant duration. Again, some of us may differ. That's my opinion, having been out there meeting with the personal care companies in the various countries. Lastly, you have to have commercial feasibility. You're not going to produce something like that at that price point and create margin and therefore sustainability for your commercial enterprise unless you have something that has clearly ingenious manufacturing processes. Okay? Now, what's the next issue that we have confronted and that you will confront in your products in nano, whether it's water or otherwise? Distribution. It's everything. What we at McGovern Capital like to think is we make technology is a commercial reality. We have faced the issues and work with the issues of the base of the pyramid. I call it dealing with the pyramid of influence, because you're going to have to influence very aspects of the market. You have to deal with the channels of distribution of whether you're going to start or complete with private enterprise, NGOs and governments, or combinations of them all, and geographic homogeneity. In Africa, it's a very difficult problem to distribute the product. Maybe a little easier in India, maybe a little bit more difficult, easier in China. Those are issues that we're confronting as we speak day to day. Bottom line is the future of nanowater, and I believe the future of nanotechnology, is really an international phenomenon, evolutionary and revolutionary, and alliances are the key. And that's why I really look forward to working with all of you through McGovern Capital, also KX Industries, and everyone on this panel. Thank you very much.
You know, listening to these talks reminded me of a personal experience I had with this. My wife is from China, and we went to visit where her father grew up in a remote village, small house with only a well. And we were going to stay there for dinner, and I was told to go out and pump water. So I was pumping water from this well, and I looked around, and about 20 feet to one side there was the outhouse, you know, and going into the ground, and about 20 feet to another direction there was a little corral with some pigs in it. And then the next door neighbor was a small engine repair shop where they dumped all the oil from the motors into the ground. And so from that point forward, for the rest of my stay in that village, the only thing I consumed was snow beer, which comes in these 3/4 liter bottles, and it's very good. So I'd highly recommend that to short-term problems. our next speaker, so that's one solution to short term. next speaker is Dr. William Lee. He's the leading scientist. He is a leading scientist in the field of nanografting. He received his PhD from the University of Tokyo in the laboratory of Kiyoshi Saito, and who is also a key scientist and a scientific advisor to Dr. Lee's company called eMembrane. This company develops membranes for dialysis, polymeric electric fuel cells, microbial cell removal and immobilization. He developed a membrane to capture virus particles in conjunction with Dr. Jeff Morgan. Prior to founding eMembrane, Dr. Lee worked for JAFCO, which is Japan's largest venture capital firm. He's published more than 20 papers and has co-invented 14 patents, all related to nanografting. So let's welcome Dr. Lee.
Thank you, Anthony, for the nice introductions, and I would like to thank the organizer as well for giving me the opportunity to present over here. eMembrane, a little bit about eMembranes. I only have 3 slides, so I won't talk for more than 30 minutes. And eMembrane is a startup company. We are based in Providence, which is from Rhode Island, and we are about 4 years old. And what we do actually is we're using our core technology called nanografting, meaning that taking any plastic, any membrane or filters that you can buy from Dow or DuPont or any chemical companies, then on the surface of this plastic or this what we call polymers in technical terms is that we are growing these nano brushes, which is these hairy filaments. And the way we do it is we want to control the density, which is the numbers of the brushes on the surface. As well, we want to control the length of the brushes. so that we can customize, because looking at, let's say, try to capture a certain target molecules, you have as small, let's say, as matter ions, heavy metals, and to a larger molecules like a bacterial, then the way we want to do it is that we want to customize the density so that you have these brushes standing on the surface, that the distance between these two brushes can sort of like hugging the target molecules. And the other part is to go vertical on the third dimensions is that you're controlling these brushes so that at a certain length, now you can multi-layer stacking this molecule together. And by doing so is that you can increase the capability of the filter or the membranes that you use to capture or to do filtrations, etc. Normally, in the filtrations industries, that you only have filters that filtering out big and small molecules. They don't have a capturing function. So here, we want to add additional value onto the membranes by putting a capturing function on it. So the base materials can be of any form, of any shape. It can be a hollow fiber, it can be a non-woven cloth, it can be a plastic film, or it can be made into a module. The way we want to do it is because we need to customize the raw materials or the device so that that can fit into the budget for the productions. Let's say here, let's say we're talking about water purifications. So you look at, like Kevin has mentioned before, different countries has different requirements for water purifications, and you have to come up with a customized materials or device that can fit into their budgets. And you're looking at water treatments, that usually they're using, currently there are more, about three different technology. One is a mixed bed, which is ion exchange. The other one is reverse osmosis. The third one will be ultrafiltration. And particularly for reverse osmosis and ultrafiltration, these are very expensive devices. They are not going to fit into the third world market. And the way we want to do it is to come up with a new device that can put into in front of each RO or ultrafiltration so that you can make the lifetime of the RO or ultrafiltration much more longer, as well as at the same time you're cleaning up the whole water much more faster in a high performance way. And you look at membranes, there are two different membranes. One is porous membranes, which is you have a lot of pores on the membrane, like ultrafiltration or microfiltration. The other one is non-porous membrane. Our technology can be applied onto these two. On the porous membrane side is that, let's say taking a microporous membrane, they have these micropores about 0.3, 0.4 micron. So if your target molecules, the one that you want to remove is a heavy metals, which is less than several nanometers in orders, or viruses, several 25, 20-something nanometers. So this target molecule, they will pass through this membrane, microfiltration very, very easily. But by the way we do it is that we put on these brushes, they're controlling the pore size of it, so that these brushes inside the pore, they will act like a fishing net. So you're doing filtrations, which you're dividing these big molecules like bacteria at the same time. At the same time, you're cleaning up the water as well. That's how we do apply our technology onto the porous membrane. On the other side of non-porous, basically non-porous, they don't allow any permeations of molecules. And by putting brushes in it, actually we can open a minute pore in angstrom orders, which is you can now go to like screening or targeting a particular target molecules, and you adjust a non-porous membrane into a minute porous film or membranes that can only allow a certain target molecule to pass through. So we are targeting from metal ions, gas, proteins, viruses, and cells, and mostly targeting on the industrial water productions, looking at the chemical industry as well as the biotech industry. And for example, in the biotech industries is that you see like in the Iraq, there are people, we are sending soldiers to the front, and they have to provide to water to make vaccinations for the military front. And to make those water is not an easy way, because you cannot use chlorinations, you cannot use chlorine to clean up the water. And particularly when try to create clean up waters, one of the main problems is this fragments of proteins or fragments of DNA from bacteria that it can contaminate the water and make contaminate the whole vaccine water as well. Here we do is by putting out technology onto those membranes is that we are targeting at purifying and separating water up to beyond PPT level, which is parts per trillion level. So you're cleaning up water in a much more efficient way. And looking at these different applications, these are the current what our technology can be applied on and what are the different industries. Starting from the 12 o'clock, you have sensors then going clockwise, you have the separation purification membrane for proteins or protein separations. Then you have antibacterial, antiviral membranes, then artificial organs, packaging materials, others like analytical tools, water treatments, and functional films, which is for the electronics industry. Currently, we are targeting on the blue circles on the water treatments as well as protein separations as well as looking at try to clean up the water by removing viruses as well as bacteria as well. We are currently trying to raise money for prototyping our devices, and that's it. Thank you.
Thank you, William. So I think this has been a great overview of the problem and looking at a couple specific technologies. Certainly, so I guess we'll enter the question phase of our panel. And I'll start off with a question. So certainly one of the big problems that the world is facing with water is desalinization. So, which is, taking the purifying seawater to make it drinkable. So I took a look at one company making a desalinization product to get an idea what is the commercial state of the art. And it was a complicated three-layer thing. They would first run the seawater through what they called slow sand with some biological element that, then they would take it and run it through a nanofilter, which has some catalysis in it also. And then finally, that would just leave them salt water, which they would then run through high-pressure reverse osmosis. So kind of an example of a real system. I don't know if that's representative. But
that's generally, for a big system, that's generally the case.
Right. So that, obviously there's, we've seen some point technologies, but do you see technologies that could simplify something like in a desalinization and not make it as complicated as a process as it is today?
Indeed, the filter that we have, one of our targets is to replace that so-called nanomembrane filter, which has got low capacity. When you use that filter, you flush air across the membrane because you can't put the water through it. So you have a waste that's generated. In our particular case, all the water goes through the filter. It's called dead-end filtration. And that result is we can reduce the size of the footprint, we could eliminate chemicals, we can save substantially on a relatively small system. It remains to be seen whether or not it's appropriate at the big municipal level, because our filters are not regenerable. They're disposable. And so those nanomembranes they have some limited life, and they're pretty good, but you got to keep regenerating them. So there's chemical cost regenerate. So it's an economic analysis that we frankly haven't done yet.
Other thoughts on desalinization?
Our technology does not treat salt at our low price point consumer household application. We'll get there, but we'll get there with a much more expensive product. We won't get there with what we're dealing with right now. And in terms of complication, to some extent, I doubt if you're going to make it any less complicated than you're talking about, because it is a multi-layered process for any effective antivirus system or bacterial system, which is certainly ours. But we don't deal with salt at this point.
We are targeting only partial on the desalination. People use electrodialysis as well to desalinate the waters. And what we're targeting is try to replace the resins that you use for this electrodialysis device. And by doing so is in order to cut the cost of those regenerations, reconditions, as well the economic analysis for the whole system.
Now, Charles, don't ask too complicated of a question.
Hi there. I had a wonderful set of presentations, and thanks for putting these folks together. But for Dr. Lee specifically, the first slide you showed with the mechanical concept of capturing particles, my first thought was sensors, and I see a bubble there in your slide.
Yeah.
Have you created any sensors or are there any prototypes or anything you want to comment on along those lines?
So far, we have been working on immobilized enzymes, using enzymes as sensors, by those, for example, those glucose sensors for monitoring the glucose levels for patients for the biomedical industry.
Okay. Yeah. I'm actually going to be at the BioMEMS and Biosensor Conference about 2 weeks from now in San Francisco, and there's a lot of folks doing lab-on-a-chip systems. I could see your sort of mechanical capture system sort of being embedded in that. Do you see this maybe going into homeland security or biohazard detection, things like that?
One thing that I want to correct is that we are not basically based on mechanical absorptions. Okay. We are playing with a lot of chemistry over here. We can put on each brush, we can put on different kind of functional groups. Depends on your target molecules, whether they, how you want to immobilize and how you want the, to capture them. And yes, of course, I mean, we're also looking, I mean, we're currently working on SBIRA for the Homeland Security, looking at ChemBio, agents, the kind of applications as well.
Yeah. Okay, thanks. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Okay. Hi. Mr. McGovern, you spoke about the need to eliminate the presence of viruses and bacteria. So what's the mechanism that you're using to eliminate these? Are you killing them, or are you just absorbing them, adsorbing them?
We're killing them. We're eliminating them and killing them.
Okay, and can you talk about how you're killing them?
I'm sorry?
Can you talk about how you're killing them?
I can't, I'm sorry. I know, but I can't disclose it at this. And I'm not trying to, I just can't, no. But we kill it, totally.
It's Peter Singer from the University of Toronto. Just to link a few of the thoughts in the various presentations, there could be very little better for the field than before the movie comes out. With Keanu Reeves that people were talking about earlier, to actually have a technology that's going to scale for arsenic in Bangladesh and 50 million people. What are the chances of accomplishing that on that time frame?
Well, I'll try to answer. It's a question of cost. I mean, a lot of these people are pretty poor and can't afford very much. A study was recently run in the face of the cancer that they now are facing and the effect from arsenic poisoning, there is an expectation, even at their low level of cost of living, they're willing to invest in the municipal treatment to get out of this mess. So, you know, I think that the chances are very real. A lot of people, a lot of companies, including our own, are spending a lot of money to address the problem, and some of the solutions are within the economic grasp, even in that kind of environment, and perhaps aided by NGOs as well.
You know, some of us contend that the arsenic problem can be great. The best alleviation or elimination of the arsenic problem is to have a household device that you can use to purify water. Because the reason why arsenic is a problem, as you probably know, is you got to go into these deep wells because surface water is so bad in Bangladesh. If you have a point of use, non-electrical, like Dean Kamen's capacity, if it's strictly gravity flow, like a carafe, in your household, you don't have to worry about arsenic.
That's right. I mean, the focus really is they made a big mistake by drilling for water, and they wound up with an arsenic problem. They're going back to surface water. And now they have to face up to the microbiological problem again.
And now they got to deal with technologies like ours, really. In the long run, that's going to be the only solution for them.
I disagree. I think that arsenic sorbents are coming of age.
Okay. Very expensive, Fred, I think. I don't know.
Mr. Tepper, I noticed your slide showed arsenic removal for arsenic 5. How well does your filter remove arsenic 3?
Very well, without any oxidation.
Thanks. Fred, I was very interested by your talk, and I just wanted to know if you had done, so you have nanorods of basically alumina, ALOH, on glass.
Yes.
And that's embedded in your paper fibers.
Yes.
Now, we know that nanorods can biointensify and can cross the blood-brain barrier and so forth.
Yes.
Experimentally. How strong is that nanorod adherence? Have you measured the de-adherence of it under various insults?
Indirectly we have, but we've gone beyond that. We've measured alumina, total aluminum content. You know, it's down in the low part per billion range, micrograms per liter, but we've done something more.
Okay.
What we've done is to determine what happens if some of it were to be digested orally. And we did some experimental work, my Russian friends did it, by the way, where they took some of the raw material, the nanoalumina rods, and digested with simulated stomach acid at pH 3.5 with pepsin added, and in about 16 hours it was dissolved. And then we came to learn that these kinds of materials are used as analgesics like Maalox, and they've been used for generations.
Okay, but they have to be in the same form. It's one of the talks that we had before.
Alumina is going to dissolve, the finer particles are going to dissolve faster than the coarser ones are using now.
Okay, okay.
Oh, this will be the last question. Who? Oh, there was one there. No? Okay, Duval.
Yes, I heard, I suppose, Tony said that desalinizing with with heat or boiling is very expensive. But if you leave the cost on side, because there are ways people have found ways to deal with the cost, such as, you know, solar energy and stuff, and they're doing that in coastal villages in India. But the question is, when you use boiling and then cooling and desalinize that way, what is the still the effect on those chemical particles that could be dissolved? Do you also remove them, or do they come back when you vaporize and then, you know, condense the water again? That's the question.
I can't address the, you know, the dynamics associated with boiling water carryover. So I can't answer the question.
I can tell you that boiling water is a pretty expensive way of treating water, believe it or not. In terms of
what they do in India is they use the reflected light with mirrors. Mm-hmm. And they have dealt with the cost very effectively in very poor villages. I think the cost, in fact, is high if you do it in a traditional way. Mm-hmm. But you can deal with the cost in other ways.
I tend to agree with Kevin. If there's no free lunch, you've got to invest in reflectors and all that sort of thing. I mean, somebody's got to pay for that.
Also, I mean, you know, my personal experience with China, most people, you know, the most population lives in, or a large number of population lives in large apartment buildings, and, you know, there's, you know, some folks just never see direct sunlight, so it's just not going to happen for them. And every individual is in charge of, you know, kind of purifying their own water. There, people take water from the tap, they put it into a big ceramic container, they let it settle to let the particulate stuff fall out, and then they scoop that and boil that for cooking. So,
I might add that, believe me, there's significant interest in our filter from India, and a specific company that's rather large. So, and I have some sense of the opportunities there.
Well, I think we're out of time, so let's thank our speakers.